My name is Adam, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Destina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Marissa will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Marissa, an alcoholic. Hi. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may find their common solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Eddie will read the steps.
My name is Eddie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood them. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Number seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Number nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Number ten, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Number 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will and for the will to carry that out. Number 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs.
Rolando will read the traditions.
Hi, my name is Rolando. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Rolando.
The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters of affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should forever remain non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn to public controversy. 11, Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to praise principles before personalities.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Kevin.
Hi, everybody. My name's Kevin. I'm an alcoholic. My sober date is December 31st, 2003. My sponsor, James M., and I'm happy living in step 11, 12, 10, 11, and 12. I got to calm down. Okay. The primary purpose is to help the still sick and suffering meth fan. Oh, I mean alcoholic, excuse me. All right, let me get to the start because I got 10 minutes, so let me do the best I can. All right, my state of mind prior to my first drink, I was a shy, frightened, and very young boy, about 12 years old. After I got my first drunk at a Christmas Eve party, I had relief of bondage of self completely. It was like a magic bullet that hit me. It helped me overcome that fear, overcome that shyness, overcome that. I believe I was an alcoholic from the very first drink. I just got some notes here. Okay, after that, it really took over my school. I didn't excel in school. I was definitely a drinker where I was trying for that magic escape. And by the time I was 16, I was finished with my schooling career, and I was working to make a living. And there was insanity in my late teenage years, and what I did is I joined the Army for discipline, and it was 1973, and they had sent me to Germany. And the irony of that, it's not an escape for alcohol. I didn't get the discipline. I got the discipline in the workforce, but they had a bar down in the basement in the barracks where they had credit. They opened up a McDonald's, and even McDonald's served beer over there. So beer was everywhere. And plus, I discovered the Oktoberfest. I didn't miss one of that. So by the skin of my teeth, I made it out of service. And after that point, again, the drunkenness, the insanity was there. And I started falling behind on my rent. Then I lost a couple of apartments. Then I became unwelcome guests at relatives, friends' house. And I alienated them and straight out homelessness. It was I spent a lot of years homeless because basically I realize now it was because of a direct result of my alcoholism. I tried a few times to get sober. I had a couple of years here, a couple of years there. And everybody said you have to get the steps in your life. And I look back in retrospect and I realize that what blocked me was my ego. Nothing was better than my opinion. I knew best on everything. And I suffered the consequences of it. I would stay in a room, even take a commitment here and there. and be a dry drunk and not incorporate the solution into my life. And some personal tragedy or something happened, some resentment took me back out. And I was reading in the big book because I got the fourth edition. And it's ironic. I always read 449, third edition on acceptance. And this sort of summed up my my life with alcoholism. I moved to a large city to make a new beginning. My life had become a series of new beginnings. In time, I picked up the drink, got good jobs, and lost them, as I had in the past. All the fear and remorse and terrible depression returned tenfold. It still did not register that my drinking might be the cause of my misery. So I sold my blood. I prostituted myself. I drank more. I became homeless, slept in the bus terminal, the train terminal. I scrounged cigarette butts on the sidewalk, and I drank from a common wine bottle with other drunks. I drank my way to the men's shelter and made it my home. I panhandled, and on and on and on. So my last drunk I got beat up pretty bad, but I finally got the steps into my life, and what I came to realize that it's a spiritual malady. I'm spiritually sick, and I finally realized what happened, what the steps did for me was that it's a process that took away resentment, fear, shame. These were all roadblocks to my connection to the higher power. These are the things that were making me, keeping me in the spiritual malady. And I understand that prayer and meditation is very important, but I learned from my sober brothers and my sponsor that the strongest and most proficient way to overcome the spiritual malady is working with the newcomer. Because, I don't know, in my eyes, if I can pull somebody through the hell I was in, I'm grateful to do it. So when you got a sponsor that's Johnny on the spot, they do it to save their own butt. So I'm really grateful. That's all I got to say. Thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Amy.
Hi there, I'm Amy, alcoholic.
Hey.
Hi, everybody. It's great to be here. I want to thank Eleanor for asking me to speak. My sobriety date is March 20th, 2002. My sponsor is Mark P. I'm currently working steps 9 through 12. And this is my home group. It's an honor and a privilege to speak here. All right, so I'm an alcoholic. Basically, a little bit about my story. Or before I get into that, I mean, I want to say if anyone's new, welcome. And I just remember coming to AG and sitting in the back, not talking to anybody, and wishing, like, oh, if I was a real alcoholic, you know, I could be happy, joyous, and free like all of these other people. And I didn't understand what it was to be an alcoholic. So when I say, you know, I'm Amy, I'm an alcoholic, you know, we all say it. But if anyone's not clear on what that means, all it really means is, you know, I have a mental obsession. I have a built-in forgetter. I forget what happens, what time when I, you know, what happens the last time I picked up. And, you know, I have this, you know, this thinking that's off. And basically it leads me to take, you know, an action, which is picking up. And when I pick up a drink, it sets off a physical allergy. And at that point, you know, the phenomena of craving set off, and I'm off to the races. And it doesn't mean, you know, I'm bad. It doesn't mean that. I'm a great egg. I'm just an alcoholic, you know, and once I pick up, there's nothing that I can do about it. I'm absolutely powerless. So if you're new and you're not quite sure about that stuff, you know, it didn't have to be for me and my experience, any of the stereotypes of what I thought it meant to be an alcoholic. And until I actually was willing to listen and sit down with someone and work the steps and the big book and really understand what it meant to be an alcoholic and have alcoholic thinking, it didn't make sense. So I didn't get relief until I was able to at least be open to that. So if you're new and you're not sure, you know, reach out to any of us. We're all friendly and here to help. A little bit about my my story. I'm from Fort Wayne, Indiana, the youngest of three. And I grew up basically with broken lenses. You know, basically my closest companions growing up were really fear and worry, you know, visited every now and then by like self-pity. And constantly, you know, worried. And nothing was so wrong, you know. It was like a pretty good place to grow up. You know, I had parents who loved me and did the absolute best that they could. And, you know, I remember my first resentment before I actually remember my first drink. And, you know, my mom wasn't well growing up. She was sick, and my dad traveled a lot for business. So there's this wonderful woman who was, like, just around to, like, meet my needs and take care of me. And she was love on two legs. I mean, anything I needed, this woman was amazing. And I remember she was getting me ready for something, and I was getting all gussied up, and I remember saying to her, no matter how much time you spend with me or how, you know, how great you are, you know, because I'm the youngest, you will have always spent more time with my, you know, my older brother and sister, you know. And she was like, what? And I was like, there's nothing that I can do. You know, I'm always, you know, less short end of the stick. Poor me, poor me, poor me, you know, eventually another drink. But that was my mindset, you know, as a kid. And, you know, the broken lenses, you know, growing up where everyone, you know, the grass was always greener, your piece of the cake was bigger, and when I got your piece, it never tasted as good as I, you know, as I thought. And that was my thinking. That was me even without a drink. And I do remember picking up my first drink. I was young. We were at our lake cottage, and it was, you know, I wanted my dad's beer. And I wanted also, you know, what wasn't mine, what I couldn't have. I just wanted it because it was yours. And I didn't like the taste at all, and I remember picking it up. And I liked all the attention that I got. You know, that was enough for me, center of attention. And for me, when I drank, you know, it certainly was not, you know, we can't differentiate the truth from the false. But for me, when I drank, I was, you know, 5'10", blonde, life of the party, the Amy that I always, you know, wanted to be. And I was a mess when I drank. I was not, you know, the way that I imagined myself to be. And, you know, drinking through college and high school, et cetera, you know, my alcoholism really took off when I, you know, finished school and moved to New York. And the whole life pursuit of, you know, everything's going to be better when I blank, when I get into graduate school, when I get married, when I get my promotion, when I get my title, when I get my other job. I mean, it was just constantly chasing, 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 beyond restless, irritable, and discontent. And, you know, I sought that ease and comfort, which I thought would come from, you know, picking up a drink. And basically, you know, as a result of going through the steps, I can see, like, my phenomenal, you know, selfish behavior as a result of my drinking and really, you know, deluded myself that when I was married, you know, I felt that, oh, it's part of being an independent woman. You know, I needed to go out drinking, you know, with my guy friends individually because I'm so independent, precocious. You know, I'm not going to be a wifey. You know, it was crazy. I did that because I needed to be around other people who drank like I did, and my husband was not an alcoholic. So anyway, I just want to say that, you know, there's a lot of pain in early sobriety, or there was a lot of pain for me in early sobriety and also being dry in AA. And nobody has to go through that experience. You know, you're in a great place where people really get into the solution and can, you know, help you get through the big book so you can change your thinking and have a spiritual experience, which is, you know, basically what it's all about. So for me, the hardest part was really admitting that I was an alcoholic. And I was in another fellowship at the time, and a sponsor said, you know, I can't take you through the big book if you're drinking. And I said, okay, I don't have to admit I'm an alcoholic, but conceptually that made sense. So I just was willing to not drink. And 30 days later, everything was going a lot better. I would not admit that it had anything to do with not drinking. So it was New Year's Eve. I called her. I was like, listen, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm definitely drinking on New Year's Eve. This is insane. And she, you know, gave me a suggestion out of the big book and said, great, you know, why don't you have three drinks? And I remember thinking in my head, okay, one with cocktails, one with dinner, one at midnight, like perfectly reasonable, you know. And I didn't know what happened. It was like, you know, 4 a.m. I was taking champagne bottles behind the bar. Let's all go to the beach. I mean, you know, and I just remember, you know, how did it happen? I don't know. That was January and my sobriety date is March. So it took me a while to like come back to the rooms and be willing to, you know, believe I might be an alcoholic. And I'm grateful for Jeff, from this group who, when I was really like, you know, Jeff, I'm not sure if I'm an alcoholic. I don't know. And he just showed me, you know, the first paragraph in We Agnostics, you know, either you have little control over the amount you take or you couldn't quit entirely, you know, when you tried. He just asked me that one question. And I was like, well, I never tried to stop. And he said, well, would you admit you have little control over the amount you take? And I said, okay. And he said, all right, so probably, you're probably an alcoholic. Get on with the steps. And that was enough for me. So I'm always grateful for Jeff for that. And basically, go figure, things got better going through, you know, the steps, which I could not have done without a sponsor because I didn't understand what alcoholism was. I didn't understand, you know, it's my thinking that needs to change until I go through the steps and go through the big book and build a relationship with a higher power that can solve all of my problems. I'm really not going to have a shot. You know, drinking is but a symptom. And I couldn't understand that for years. I kept comparing other people's story to my drinking, and it was about my thinking. So anyway, the good news is you're in a great place. It works, and you're surrounded by people who basically have had this experience. And the beauty of the first step for me in really, you know, accepting that I'm an alcoholic, you know, when I went through it with my current sponsor, Mark P., I'm really grateful for having a deep understanding of this, is that, you know, basically I'm kind of off the hook. Like if I really accept it, you know, I don't need to have any shame, because if I have any shame about being an alcoholic, that assumes there's something that I could have done differently. And, you know, really embracing the first step, you know, I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's unmanageable. You know, it's kind of a precious thing. It's like embracing that broken part of me. There's nothing that I could do other than like accept that and get on with the rest of the program. And until I could really accept that I can't, and, you know, it's not because I'm good. It's not because I'm bad. It's not because I'm not normal. I have this allergy, and this is what happens. And, you know, there's a free solution that works for, like, all of us. So, you know, it's good to know that I'm not terminally unique. Also one of my delusions. So, anyway, I just want to just, you know, let people know that it does work. And if you're confused, you know, get a sponsor, ask someone what it means to be an alcoholic, and just spend the time, at least investigate, you know, give it a real first step in the big book with a sponsor. It works. Thanks.
CDs of tonight's meeting can be purchased from Liz and David at the audio table at the next week meeting. Additionally, AA speaker tapes can be borrowed from the lending library. As was said, this meeting is open to anyone. However, we are an anonymous fellowship and ask that what you hear and whom you see here remain here. If you are speaking at another group and wish for some of us to come for support, please write the information on the sheet on the bulletin board. Our speaker tonight is Bill B.
Hi, I'm Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Bill. And my sobriety date is April 8th, 1962. And is that better? Okay. Well, I need to speak into this because, see, I was born in Brooklyn, and I now live in Little River, South Carolina. And when those two accents cross, sometimes you can't understand me, you know. I mean, y'all, you know. So, thank you very much for the invitation to share tonight. This is an overwhelming group. Yeah. Good job, kid. Good job. Also, I'd like to thank some of my good friends who came to support me tonight, like Brian and Walter and Bill and my new friend Mitch. I appreciate it very, very much. I'm a native New Yorker, and I got drunk in New York and sobered up in New York. And but I had no idea all the time that I was drinking that I was an alcoholic. I had no idea. I grew up in an alcoholic family. My father's an alcoholic. My both grandfathers were alcoholics. My grandmother was an alcoholic. Six brothers died of alcoholism. But nobody in my family ever called anybody an alcoholic. That name was reserved for the Bowery derelict. So in my mind, that's what an alcoholic was. See? And when Kevin was speaking, I understood exactly where he was coming from, and when he was talking about that feeling so low self-esteem and uncomfortable when you were a kid. That's the way I was when I was a kid. And when I was 13 years old, and being in church reminded me of it tonight, I went away to a seminary to study to become a Maryknoll missionary priest. So with my big ego, I was going to go to China and save all the Chinese, you know. That was my goal. And 4 years later, my spiritual director came to me and he said, William, I think one day you might make a wonderful father, but not in this place. So he suggested I leave. And I came out into the world, you know, where all you beautiful young women are. And I began my alcoholic career. I continued my education at St. John's University, and I went to work for a New York City newspaper. Back in my younger days, in the early 50s, there were 18 newspapers in the city of New York. Believe it or not. Today there are only 2.5. I won't tell you which I think the half is, except it's the New York Times, but I won't say that. Anyway, so I got a job as a copy boy for this newspaper, and while I was going to, you know, study at St. John's, and I broke a story. And just very, very quickly, the fire commissioner for the city of New York was shaking down building contractors and sharing the money with the mayor. And they caught him and they indicted him with 99 counts of stealing city funds. And one night I saw this elderly gentleman sitting in my class at St. John's University, and I found out he was the fire commissioner awaiting trial. And my class happened to be an ethics class. He was studying ethics, you know. I thought it was a hell of a story, you know, being, you know, 99 counts stealing city funds and he's studying ethics. It's about time, right? So the next morning, I turned the story into the city editor, and big red, this is the old New York Journal American. Some of you who have same color hair I have remember that paper. And big red headline, first edition, you know, by commissioner, blah, blah, blah. And that afternoon, the city editor called me over, and he said, you got a nose for news, kid, so I'm making you a reporter. And that's how it happened. I was 18 years old, wet behind the ears, scared to death, didn't know what I was doing. And he sends me over to Brooklyn to be a police reporter on the lobster shift. That's midnight to 9 in the morning when everything happens in Brooklyn, right? Anyway, at least it did that. It probably still does. Anyway, I said to him, his name is Eddie Mahar, by the way. He's a great, great city editor. Great city editor. And an alcoholic who stopped drinking on his own. Of course, they were going to fire him. His wife was going to leave him, and the Cardinal Spellman back then was going to fire him as the president of the Catholic Institute of the Press, so he stopped drinking on his own, and he became the meanest, angriest guy I had ever met in my life. You know, that's what happens if we don't find Alcoholics Anonymous. He was so mean and angry. I mean, he was the only man I knew that could string together 17 profane words and make a perfect English sentence. You know? I know that for a fact because he always used them on me. But anyway, sent me over to Brooklyn, and I walked up to the turnout desk, and Eddie Mahar said to me, just go up, look up the other reporters, and they'll show you what to do. So I went over there, and I asked the police lieutenant, where can I find some other reporters? And he pointed across Flatbush Avenue to the Edison Bar and Grill. And he said, you'll find some of them in there. Well, he was wrong. I found all of them in the Edison Bar and Grill. And I thought, well, I'll go in and introduce myself, and I did. And they were very nice to me. Most of them, they were all much older than myself at the time. And reporter for the Daily Mirror, the Daily News, the Herald Tribune, the PM, and World Telegram, the Sun. I can go on and on. 18 newspapers. Brooklyn Eagle, Bronx Home News. I'll stop. Anyway. And one of them said to me, what are you drinking? I said, I'll have a Coke. He said, the hell, you'll have a Coke. And he got me a shot and a beer. And another reporter bought me a shot and a beer. And they started having fun with the kid, and they started passing me down the bar, buying me shots and beers. I walked into the Edison Bar and Grill at midnight. I walked out at 4 o'clock in the morning a veteran newsman, because that's what alcohol did for me. And if you remember your first drink, the magic elixir, it just changed how I felt. I mean, it just made me feel whole. It filled that gap. And this, I'm not being melodramatic. That's exactly what it did for me right away. Okay. And from that point on, I began to use alcohol before I did anything. I'd get ready by having a few drinks. If I wanted to call a girl or ask her to go on a date, I'd have a few drinks to call her. And then have a few more to actually take her, you know. And that's the way I was. I used alcohol to live, to open up my life, to be able to do things that I was not able to do, like dance and flirt and other things. Anyway, yeah, I was told this is a... I got the message. Anyway, I get out there once in a while. At the General American, they found out I could write. They brought me in on night side rewrite, and then they found out I could really write. They brought me in on day side rewrite. I was writing for 7 editions, and then they started giving me bylines. And by the time I was 23 years old, I was a byline feature writer for the largest evening newspaper in the world. I say that because that's the truth. That's a fact. By the time I was 26 years old, I was the obituary editor for the largest evening newspaper in the world. It's a big difference. Big difference. See, as a byline writer, you go around the country covering big stories. Like the Sam Shepard in Cleveland, who, you know, allegedly killed his wife. First Sputnik shot in space. The last execution at Sing Sing Penitentiary was a dilly. Went down to Alabama to cover George Wallace closing the doors to the Black University. And then I started getting fired. All directly as a result of my drinking. Directly as a result of my drinking. I didn't know it then, like you didn't know it then, Kevin. I didn't know it then, and but that's what happened. And fired for absenteeism, stealing my expense account. One time I got fired for wrapping up my car while being on a job. And I kept getting demoted, you know. I got brought in to Nightside Rewrite again. Then, anyway, I finally, by 3 years later, I wound up as the obituary editor. And by this time, I was a daily drinker and a daily drunk. I was spending most of my time at Moochie's Saloon, Cuckoo's or Tootie's. Those are my three wonderful joints. They were high. I liked Tootie's because it was the only saloon I knew that had a barmaid with a beard. But anyway, that's where I was spending my time. So I was stealing the obituaries out of other newspapers and sending them into the composing room. And I kept getting notes in my box from the city that saying, we want fresh obits, you know, people that died tonight, or early this morning, you know. And so when I sent one, accidentally, I guess, I tore one out of a paper that was 10 days old and sent it in. I knew I was going to get fired, so I quit. I got a job working for a magazine, news magazine, and traveling all around the country again, becoming big stories. That job lasted me 3.5 years until I was about to get fired. Turning into phony story, and the magazine got into trouble. And I quit. I got a job working for WOR Radio, writing radio shows. I had wonderful, wonderful opportunities. You know, isn't that true in our lives, the opportunities that we have, you know? And that this disease just takes away from us. I lasted at WOR for six months. And then I got a job at a small PR agency. Because every PR man I ever met, I thought, was a drunk like me, so I thought I'd fit into that. But I didn't, and then I became unemployable. In the meantime, when things weren't too bad, I got married. I married a lovely, lovely Italian girl, came from a very large Italian family, 16 children, and there was no alcoholism at all in her family. And only one boy, by the way. One boy. All those girls. I asked him, his name was Anthony, I asked him one day, what is it like growing up with all those girls? He said, I didn't know until I was 13 that I didn't have to sit down to pee. You know, he was a very, very, very interesting guy, you know. And I fit in that family like, you know, putting an oak into a bush. Anyway, I quickly got the nickname Doozy Potts. If anybody's Italian, that means you're crazy, right? Yeah, crazy. And I was, and that's the way, you know, and my wife didn't know what to do with me, you know. Because it was the early days of newspaper business. I was running around, and then, anyway, being married and now we began to have children, you know, that takes money. and drinking like an alcoholic takes money. And so, you know, I started getting into debt. I started, you know, for my first, you know, deep involvement in finance was with Beneficial Finance Company. Borrowed $50 to last me the weekend. I couldn't pay them back $50, so I borrowed $100 from local loan. I paid them back the $50. Couldn't pay back the $100, so I went over to household. I borrowed $200, paid back the $100. I thought I found the key to financial success, you know. By the time I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I owed 5 finance companies, 3 banks, 2 loan sharks, and my Aunt Jenny. And Aunt Jenny was the only one that was willing to wait and didn't charge any vigorish. I began to sink deeply into this disease. You know, this progressiveness of alcoholism is really something. I had no idea, and I swear to God, I had no idea what was happening to me. Like I'm sure you did, had no idea. And as I was beginning to lose these things and get into more and more trouble, I began to get a lot of trouble, bad check charges and that kind of stuff. I'd come to out of blackouts in the saloons in New York, Third Avenue saloons. Remember when I had the elevator train? No, you don't remember. You're too young to remember that. The sawdust on the floor, spittoons at the bar rails, which most drunks use as a shortcut to the men's room. My favorite kind of saloon, you know? And I wrote, what the hell is going on? I mean, I couldn't understand why things were slipping away. I was losing control, you know? I didn't understand. By the time I was 27 years old, we had 4 children. We had lost 2 homes, and we were living in my mother-in-law's basement. I had a car, but it was up on blocks because every time I got $97 to register it, I got drunk instead. I began to blow up. I never was a lightweight, but at one point I weighed about 310 pounds. I was known on 45th Street, Steak Row, and Pen and Pencil, all those joints, as the moon. Hey, look at the moon's out tonight. And I'd waddle in, you know, became a walking fruitcake. And one night on one of these low-down bars, I came to the conclusion that I was crazy. Being crazy for an alcoholic makes a lot of sense. It explained for me why I was doing all the things I was doing, getting into all the trouble I was getting in over and over and over again. And I made the mistake of mentioning it to my wife, who for some reason was still with me. And so she called our family doctor, who suggested I go see a psychiatrist. And so one Saturday afternoon, I made an appointment. I went over to see the psychiatrist. I felt good about going because I needed help. I knew I did. And I felt so good about going that I got ready. You know, I stopped off at Fred Funk's saloon and had a few shooters. And so by the time I got into the psychiatrist's office, I was really ready. He sat me in front of his desk. He didn't have a couch. Never will forget it. And which worried me. I thought you lay on a couch in a psychiatrist's office and you tell him how your father beat you and all that kind of stuff. Instead, he sat me in front of his desk in a chair, and he was a little skinny guy, and I laid my belly on his desk, and he looked at me over half glasses, and he said to me, what are you doing here? I said, I'm nuts. I'm really nuts. I'm going crazy. I'm either crazy or I'm going crazy. And he says, why? And I began to tell him some of the things I'm talking about tonight and other stories, and then he stopped me, and he said to me, you drink, don't you? That threw me. I mean, why would he ask me that? I didn't know. I swear to God, I had no idea why he would ask me that question. And I said, yeah, I have a few. Well, I know now because he was breathing. I was breathing on him, you know. and I said, you know, he said, you drink beer, you drink wine, you drink bourbon, you drink. What he did is he painted a picture of a kid who was 27 years old who drank everything he could get his hands on. And then he asked me that magic question. He said, do you know what an alcoholic is? And I said, yes, I do. And I described the guy on the Bowery. And he said to me, that's the alcoholic in the final stages of his disease. And he said, through the use and abuse of alcohol, blah, blah, blah. And I suddenly got the impression he was suggesting that I was an alcoholic. And I got teed off. I really did. But I didn't know what to do. And then he handed me a phone number, and he said, if you want help, call these people up. And it was the Intergroup Office of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, go see them. Well, I did, because I didn't know what else to do. And I walked into the office, and never will forget it. It was a big guy, bigger than me, big guy, named John. Big tweed jacket, handlebar mustache. And he put his big paw of a hand in mine, and he said, my name is John. Do you have a problem with alcohol? I said, hell no, but there's a psychiatrist in Queens that thinks I do. And he sent me over here for some information. I want some information. He says, well, I'll tell you what. Why don't I take you to an AA meeting tonight? It was a Saturday. I said, no, I can't go tonight, John. I'm kind of busy. I have nothing to do. And so he said, oh, well, anytime you want to go, give me a call. He handed me his card. And you can't even make this up, Mitch, even in movies. And I took his card. I was about to walk out, and I just glanced at it, and it said, John So-and-so, Vice President, Chase Manhattan Bank. And I was running short, you know. Oh, man. So I said, I think I can make it tonight, John, you know. And that's truly how God got me to my first AA meeting, okay? He took me out to Garden City, Long Island, Saturday night. Back in those days, ladies wore their finest, right? And the guys wore their suits and ties. And they told me I was going to hear an alcoholic speak, try to identify. There's a lot of new people here tonight, and I want to congratulate you, by the way, for being here. It's wonderful. It's great. And to see all the young faces, and wow, Alcoholics Anonymous. And so don't compare yourself with Bill. Just try to identify with some of the things, the feelings, and the progressiveness of alcoholism. And so I heard this guy talk about, you know, trouble at home, automobile wrecks, losing jobs, and I kept saying to myself, hell, that can happen to anybody. You don't have to be an alcoholic, you know. And if you don't want to be an alcoholic, you don't have to be. You know, you just die from it. So, and then he asked me where I live. I told him, and they said, well, your home group meets on Tuesdays and Saturdays, and it's in Richmond Hill, blah, blah. Well, I wasn't going to tell him I couldn't go to my home group. I'm not going to go to my home group. I don't want anybody to see me going Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, in the shape I was in, they only... I never thought that on Saturdays they used to see me urinating on their hedges, but to go to Alcoholics Anonymous was crazy. So I went 3 miles out of my way to the Woodhaven group, stayed around about 3 months. Took me that long to prove I wasn't an alcoholic by comparing myself, and then I left. And 12 months later, I was on a climbed out on the window of the old Margarita Hotel over here on 21st. It's torn down now. It's on the 8th floor, and there was a air shaft. And I decided I was going to get it over with, because at 28 years old, my life was over. That's what this disease can do to you. And that's what it did to me. Through the grace of God, I didn't jump. And crawled back in, came back home. And the guy called my mother-in-law's phone, and my wife had called him, and asked me if I'd like to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous and give it another try. And I said yes. And that was, I say, April 8th, 1962. And I came back to the Woodhaven group, and a guy named Benny Michelson, a Jewish jeweler from Brooklyn, took me under his wing. After the meeting that night, he brought me into the kitchen. Back in those days, we drank coffee out of mugs, not styrofoam cups. You can't get sober washing styrofoam cups. And ashtrays, and back in those days, we had smoking meetings. Fabulous. And my job was to wash the coffee cups, the mugs, and the silverware, and the ashtrays. Something happened to me when I put my hands in that hot, soapy water and began to wash those mugs. I know now what it was. It was being of service. It was getting out of myself. It was for the first time not being that self-centered, selfish, me-first guy. And it began to take hold. Something began to take hold. And then later on, I was promoted to make coffee. Man, what a thrill that was, you know. Get there early, you know, stand around, meeting all the guys when they come in, and so on and so forth. And that's where my sobriety began, and Benny took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He introduced me to his God. I was estranged from mine, and his God was the God I had been looking for all of my life, a loving friend, someone who had been caring for me from the day I was born, who was watching over me every drink I took, and led me back into Alcoholics Anonymous. And he's still my God today. Benny Michelson's God. And the family, we began to get sober together. My wife got into Al-Anon, which is very important. And couldn't get a job in New York. You get a bad rep in New York if you did what I did. And moved to Nashville, Tennessee. Wonderful job. Family expanded. We went from 4 children to 9 children. Well, a lot of things begin to work again when you're sober up, you know. Lived in Nashville for 6 years, then moved to Cleveland for a couple of years, another big job. Then I had the opportunity to come back to New York and team up with 3 guys who were starting in an entertainment company. I had gotten into the entertainment business in Nashville, Tennessee, country music business. And these three guys and myself, we started an independent motion picture production company and a talent management company, and we did very well. And it's the progressiveness of sobriety is far greater, I believe, than the progressiveness of alcoholism, if we want it to be, if I wanted it to be. I stayed very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was taught this by a guy named W.A. Boyd in Nashville, Tennessee. He said to me, if I would take one hand and place it in the hand of God and the other hand in the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous, it would take me on the greatest ride I've ever been on, and I'm still on that ride. I'm 73 years old. I'm 21 on the inside, and I believe the best is yet to come. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. I have seen it in these rooms. I have seen it, and I have touched it, and I've smelled it. In the seminary, I tried to find God, but I couldn't see him, touch him, or feel him. In Alcoholics Anonymous, here he is. He's as live and as real to me right now as he was this morning when I got up out of bed and knelt and asked him to keep me sober today. So it has been a wonderful, wonderful journey for me and a wonderful journey for our family. I'll share this because I no longer get royalties. So I got to know my wife introduced me to Lois Wilson back in 1975. And when I got to know her a little bit and found and learned more about this miraculous story of Bill and Bob and her and Annie, I asked her for permission to do a movie about all of that. And she gave me her permission, and I spent months with a tape recorder recording all of reminiscences. Lois and my wife and I became very, very close friends. I say that because it's true and because it was such a wonderful privilege. And so I wrote a movie called My Name is Bill W., which some of you may have seen, with James Woods and James Garner and Joe Beth Williams. And my sponsor said, I'll never be able to make a greater 12-step call. I used to not share that. And then my sponsor said to me, that's because you got such a big, fat ego. That's why you don't share it. Now, the truth is, I do have a big, fat ego. In fact, I got so much humility, I'm proud of it. He said to me, you don't talk about that because you want people to think you're such a nice, humble guy. Yeah, well, I'm not. I'm not. I'm who I am, and I can live with me. God gave me a wonderful gift, a present that I wasn't going to throw back in his face. And he's given me a few more along the way. And as I said, that's why I say the best is yet to come. The things that happen to us in sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous are phenomenal. Recovery, the gift of recovery is incredible. I mean, when I heard some people stand up tonight and say, I'm sober 27 days, I'm sober 18 days, I'm sober 74 days, the look on your face is, I mean, you don't find that in a saloon. You don't. At least I didn't, you know. You only can find the miracle of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to tell you a little story in closing because I think you're getting ready to pick up the other card, aren't you? Oh, okay. I had a mother-in-law, my wife's mother, little short Italian lady. She was less than 5 feet tall, but she was very big spiritually. And I always thought she hated my guts because we moved into her basement. And every time I staggered home, maybe, you know, I'd come home once in a while. And she was always, to get to her basement, you had to walk back through the back door, down the steps to the basement. And here was the dining room. And she was always sitting at the dining room table praying. Always, I could come in at 4 o'clock in the morning. She'd be sitting there praying, you know. And I would stand there screaming at her to stay out of my life. You know, hell, I don't know. When I say praying, she had two stacks of prayer cards, two sets of rosary beads, the New Testament, the Old Testament, and the lives of the saints. Now that's praying, you know. She saw what this drunk was doing to her daughter and her grandchildren. And she never said a word. When Bernadette wanted to leave me, when she couldn't really handle it anymore, Mama said to her, you can't leave him. He's a sick man and he needs you. How did she know that? Because she was so spiritual. Then when I got sober, I was sober a few months, and then I knew everything, right? I had the answers for everybody, right? Then Bernadette really couldn't stand me. She wanted out. Mama said to her, you can't leave him now. Somebody else will get all the good stuff, you know. So that was Mama. That was Mama. When we were living in Nashville, we were having our, either the fifth, or the fifth, the Robert, yeah. Mama came down. I brought her down on the plane and to take care of Bernadette and the kids, and she loved that. She loved that. And one night, I went into the den to do some writing, and Mama, Bernadette was in bed, the kids were in bed, and Mama came in. She was heading for the dining room to do some praying, and since that, she took a shortcut into the den, and she sat down next to me, and she looked up at me, and she said, you know, Bill, all of my life, I've read the New Testament, and I read all about all the miracles that Jesus did. And then I read the lives of the saints, and I see all the miracles that they did. And she said to me, I always wondered what it would be like to see a real miracle. And then she put her hand on my shoulder, and she said, and now I have. Mama saw the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. She saw it so vividly. I didn't see it. I didn't see it until she... And when she went into the dining room to do some praying, I sat there, and I, of course, I started crying. And then I thought, my wife is in the bedroom where I'm going to go sleep next to her. My children are snug in their beds, and they're safe, and they've been fed. And I got this lovely woman staying with us. And where did all this come from? It came from Alcoholics Anonymous, because there was no more dirty saloons. You know, there was no more, you know, all that stuff, you know? And so I guess I want to just leave you with that, that sometimes we don't realize the great gift. There were 44 million alcoholics in this country alone, and only 2.5 million in Alcoholics Anonymous. What a gift. What a privilege. Don't throw it away. Thank you.